On the borderline, Russian troops await their orders, misinformation abounds, and the news lens remains focused on Ukraine. Are they anti-Semitic or just pro-Palestinian? We examine the purging of certain voices in the German media. And thousands of miles from home and the story they still long to cover. But at least some Afghan journalists are safe.
Journalists, journalists!
In exile.
Hello, I'm Richard Gisbert, and you're at The Listening Post, where we don't cover the news, we cover the way the news is covered. The Ukraine story is a war of nerves that still threatens to turn into something more. That word that reporters use, tensions, escalate, de-escalate, then escalate again. This roller coaster of a standoff between Moscow and Washington is as much about messaging as it is about military capabilities. The U.S. contends Russia was ready to invade and had a false flag operation prepared to serve as a pretext. The Kremlin maintains it's still exploring diplomatic options, accusing the West of hyping the story, although the more than 100,000 Russian troops stationed on the border with Ukraine will have that effect. In this information war, it's advantage Moscow. Putin's grip on Russia's media, particularly the broadcast side, means he does not face the same kind of scrutiny domestically that his Western counterparts do. And across the West, increased skepticism about politicians and news outlets makes misinformation, some of it spread by the Russian media, easier to sell. However, Washington is trying out some new messaging tactics of its own. Our starting point this week is the Kremlin.
'Photo opportunities can be awkward. They can make for uncomfortable viewing. Take this past Monday and this gift to meme makers everywhere. Courtesy of the Kremlin. There was Russian President Vladimir Putin and his foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, an alleged meeting designed to convince audiences that Russia, with all those troops piled up on its border with Ukraine, was in fact trying to be diplomatic.
It looked a bit clumsy, starting from the distance they were talking at, Lavrov and Putin, pushing the Americans to concessions, pushing them so that Washington and the EU would satisfy the Russian conditions.
Discussing how the diplomacy was going, Lavrov said, things aren't going exactly as we'd hoped, our demands are still on the table, but they're not being met, and we see room for further diplomatic talks, but not indefinitely. In order to say, well, we tried diplomacy, you didn't really give in to our demands, our requests, you didn't take them seriously, and so we had no choice but to escalate.
There is also some stagecraft coming out of Washington.
The United States has information that Russia is planning to stage fabricated attacks by Ukrainian military or intelligence forces as a pretext for a further invasion of Ukraine.
Including that allegation, based on American intelligence reports, that the Russians were planning a false flag operation. Coming from the same U.S. State Department that roughly 20 years ago cited intelligence reports on Saddam Hussein's supposed weapons of mass destruction as evidence to justify invading Iraq, now citing similar sources when it briefs reporters on Ukraine. In 2003, most of the U.S. media swallowed the lie about WMDs.
A despotic regime that had the intention to develop weapons of mass destruction, had weapons of mass destruction, used weapons of mass destruction.
This time around, American journalists are far more skeptical.
You don't have any evidence to back it up other than what you're saying.
The intelligence failures that led to the Iraq war loom over everything that the intelligence community attempts to do at this point. And I don't just mean that in sort of the abstract. When you look at Russian, Chinese, or just critics of the United States in general, they point specifically to the image of Colin Powell sitting at the United Nations trying to make the case for WMDs in Iraq. I mean, you see this on social media every single time the U.S. intelligence community puts out a statement like they did this month. They always go to the image of Colin Powell in Iraq. So it is just an ever-present threat that the U.S. has to deal with.
We have to remember that it's not just the Iraq war. There's also been a lot of contested claims and intelligence since then. Just last year, and we had the story about Russia paying bounties to the Taliban to attack U.S. soldiers. That ended up being unproven, and military officials said they had no evidence of it.
The defense secretary today said Russia appeared...
And we've had claims over this entire Ukraine crisis where U.S. officials and anonymous intelligence officials have told journalists that a Russian invasion is imminent, and those warnings have not materialized.
The State Department's move, flagging the false flag operation, was preemptive. That's a departure from 2014, when Russia last invaded Ukraine, annexed Crimea, and the U.S. was caught flat-footed in a wave of Russian misinformation. TV channels beaming out of Moscow played a big part in that and remained vital to the Kremlin's messaging, telling their audiences that Russian speakers in Ukraine are now in grave danger and need Moscow to protect them.
Russia не может не остановить эту войну, не может. Мы что должны ждать? Пока там будут концлагеря? Пока они газом будут травить свое население?
Sometimes the Ukrainians and extremists operating on the far right there make it easy for the Russian media, such as when they provide pictures of women and children ready to defend the homeland, images taken by neo-Nazi groups that are training Ukrainian militias. There is no denying the authenticity of the images, the relevance of the story. But Russian news outlets have been giving it a disproportionate amount of play.
It's a well-known Russian approach. Those they don't agree with, Ukrainians or Americans, they call them fascists. But in reality, there are no grounds to say fascists play any role in forming Ukraine's agenda. Back in 2014, nobody was ready for the flow of propaganda pouring from Russian TV channels. But after 8 years of de facto war in Ukraine, the Americans have learned pretty well. And they're finding some antidotes for the Kremlin's use of mass media and propaganda in achieving its objectives.
What propaganda needs to do is not necessarily convince people of things that are not true. It needs to convince them that things that are true are not. Russian propaganda is not aimed at trying to convince American publics to believe Kremlin talking points. It is aimed at creating confusion, mistrust, doubt, and the Kremlin does that quite well. I mean, you look at RT and Sputnik, their target is not trying to attract audiences to Russia, it's trying to repel them from the West. And they're very strategic in how they try to undermine opposition to the Kremlin's geopolitical strategic goals.
Misinformation aside, this is the history Russia would like the world to focus on, NATO's expansion to the east. The absorption of former Soviet client states into NATO began in 1990 with German reunification and the de facto defection of East Germany to the Western Alliance. In 1999, Poland, Hungary, and the Czech Republic, each newly democratized, joined the list. In 2004, another 7 countries, from Bulgaria in the south to Estonia in the north, did the same. 4 more have joined NATO since. In total, 15 countries have effectively changed sides, bringing the Western Alliance east right to Russia's doorstep. Throughout that period, Russian hardliners were told by Western diplomats that those new democracies had the right to choose their allegiances. But what happened in Ukraine in 2014 was hardly democratic. After the elected president, Viktor Yanukovych, tilted the country away from NATO and towards Moscow, he was overthrown in a popular uprising, strongly supported in the West. And Ukraine is where Moscow is making its stand.
Well, we shouldn't say it was an anti-democratic revolution. It is true that the revolution had very prominent anti-democratic and actually fascist elements that have deepened their influence in the country since. Now, as for NATO's expansion, Russia does have legitimate security concerns, and it's not just Putin. This has been complained about by Russian politicians for a very, very long time, with the West really not giving it that much notice. Let's not pretend that NATO moving into a neighboring country potentially is some sort of benign move that Russia can ignore any more than the United States could ignore if suddenly China started putting troops and weapons into Mexico.
The idea that this is some imminent threat to Russia is just absolutely ludicrous, as is the idea that NATO is encircling Russia. Right now, NATO countries only touch 6% of Russia's borders. If you added Ukraine to that, the number wouldn't be that much higher. Russia is an enormous country, an enormous military superpower. Ukraine sought independence from the Soviet Union, gave up its nuclear weapons in 1994 in order for its sovereignty to be respected by its neighbors, and Russia is the one that's violated that treaty again.
That is yet another angle, treaty violations you will not see covered on Russian television, and that is the ace that Vladimir Putin holds in this information war. His country produces some quality, oppositional, even Nobel Prize-winning journalism, in print and online. But the television sector remains firmly under the Kremlin's control, doing its bidding, its very best to make Putin look good, even when the photo ops do not.
To Germany now, and what one human rights organization is calling an anti-Arab purge in the media there. Two more journalists fired this past week after being accused of anti-Semitism. Flo Phillips is here with the details, starting with what happened at Deutsche Welle.
Richard, DW, the state-funded broadcaster, has an Arabic language arm that employed two German-Palestinian journalists, Zahi Alawi and Yasser Abu Malik, until this past Monday, when they were both fired after an internal inquiry into anti-Semitic Facebook posts, some of them from long ago. Here's an example from Zahi Alawi. What the terrorist state of Israel is doing to the Palestinians is a repeated Holocaust. Alawi posted that back in 2014, during the Israeli assault on Gaza, which killed 2,200 Palestinians, more than 500 of them children. He rejects the accusation of anti-Semitism, as do six colleagues at DW Arabic, all of Palestinian or Arab origin, all fired for similar reasons, all in the last 2 weeks, and another eight remain under investigation. There's a pattern to the firings. Right-wing, pro-Israeli groups dig up old posts, go after the journalists responsible online, pressuring their employers to get rid of them. Critics of these firings say some of the anti-Semitic labelling comes down to the religion or heritage of the journalist. Take Nemi El Hassan, a prominent German-Palestinian who was about to start a high-profile TV presenting job until far-right blogs shared footage of her attending a pro-Palestine rally 7 years earlier. And the story turned into a mainstream media pile-on.
Auf Demonstrationen sich bewegt, die zur Auslöschung Israels aufrufen, hat im öffentlich-rechtlichen Rundfunk finanziert von öffentlich-rechtlichen Gebühren, von unseren Gebühren, einfach mal rein gar nicht zu suchen.
The World War II Holocaust remains a touchy subject in Germany, which is also home to the largest Palestinian diaspora in the West, and where German journalists of Arab descent now find themselves in a hostile environment.
Thanks, Flo. 6 months ago, Afghanistan was topping the global news agenda. After two decades of occupation, U.S. forces withdrew, and in their wake, the Taliban returned to power. The media's attention has since turned elsewhere, despite the fact that Afghans have so many stories that still need reporting, and they're not getting that from their domestic news outlets. The Taliban's censorship, unpredictable and often strict, has not made it easy. News organizations lack the money and resources that the job requires, and they've lost a lot of journalists who have fled, some in fear for their lives, others who say they just cannot work under such conditions. As the International Federation of Journalists puts it, Afghanistan risks becoming a news desert. The Listening Post's Meenakshi Ravi now with the story of Afghan journalists and where they find themselves 6 months after the Taliban takeover.
A number of us female journalists had groups on WhatsApp and Facebook Messenger. I got a text in a group saying that the Taliban had entered Kabul. No one ever believed that all of a sudden Kabul, the capital city of Afghanistan would also be under the control of the
Taliban.
After the collapse of the government, I stayed in Kabul for another month. I thought the situation for the media would be all right. I thought the Taliban might have really changed. Unfortunately, though, 1.5 months after the collapse of the government, I just lost hope.
It was the 8th of September 2021, less than a month after the Taliban had swept into Kabul and took power. A small group of women gathered to protest. Two journalists from the investigative newspaper Etalat Rose were covering the demonstration when they were picked up by Taliban security. 4 hours later, the men were released. The extent of their beating was clear. For Zaki Daryabi, the founder and editor of the paper, it was evident Afghanistan was no longer a place for journalists.
Something I really was not expecting was the kind of violence, torture, and beating that happened to my colleagues. I never thought they would come out of prison in this state. It is very hard for me to explain the impact of losing the Etalat Rose office, my colleagues there, and also losing the freedom to do our work. I really can't go into detail.
Many Afghan journalists who left Afghanistan after the fall of Kabul had very legitimate reasons to fear for their lives, given that in the past just 1 year, until the fall of Kabul, the level of targeted killings focused on civil society members, journalists, was at the peak. So these journalists left the country immediately.
A lot of journalists left the country, but still there are many journalists still in Afghanistan and trying to work. For instance, my radio, Radio Begum, is one of the last media dedicated to women that is still working. And surprisingly, Taliban allowed us to keep broadcasting. But at the moment, the main challenge is not really Taliban. It's the lack of income for our media. That is our main struggle. This is not for only for us, for all Afghans we are facing this problem. So I understand that journalists had to leave the country.
Hamida Aman was one of the only journalists based in Afghanistan who agreed to speak with us. Most of the others we contacted said they didn't want the attention. Their work is dangerous enough as it is. Those on the outside were freer to speak. Lutfullah Najafizada was the head of Tolo News, one of Afghanistan's most widely watched 24-hour news channels.
2 decades, trillions of dollars, thousands of lives.
He was already outside the country when the Taliban took over. He hasn't made it back in yet. Shogofa Siddiqui and Zaki Daryabi both ran prominent news outlets, an all-woman TV station and the Etalat Rose newspaper. In the weeks after Kabul fell, they realized there was no way they could stay. They fled on evacuation flights. Siddiqui is in Canada and Daryabi in the United States. It's difficult to get exact numbers, but estimates are that over the past 6 months, more than 1,500 Afghan journalists left the country, scattering across the globe, from Pakistan to Albania to the United States. Among those who remain, many are still waiting to make their escape. The hemorrhaging of the Afghan media space has had a domino effect. Within the first 100 days of Taliban rule, more than 250 television stations, radio stations, and newspapers all shut down.
Over the last 2 decades, media in Afghanistan managed to find its rightful place. It was a big achievement, but it was not an easy process. Whether it was during Hamid Karzai's presidency or Ashraf Ghani's, we always had a lot of people being targeted in the Afghan media family. But now, after 15th of August 2021, whatever freedom of speech was achieved in the last 2 decades is really in danger. Today, the situation is such that there is no motivation to work in the media.
It's always been very difficult to be a journalist in Afghanistan, and at the moment difficulties are even more, especially for a woman journalist. It's difficult to go out, to ask questions, to be in the public space, but we do what we can. But again, the issue here is the lack of finance and the lack of revenue for us. We are desperate, and I tried to knock to all doors, but the response from the international donors is so slow and it's so bureaucratic. We are in a hurry and we need desperately to find a solution.
After the government was taken over by the Taliban, all the structures of the media industry collapsed. There is no legal support for journalists. Access has been badly limited, and the authority of the media is almost completely lost. Journalists had earned some trust in society. We were able to ask for accountability from the government. The fall of Kabul has taken all of this from the media.
Tolo News decided, rightfully so, to stay in Afghanistan and continue their work. Unfortunately, some of my colleagues had to leave Afghanistan after the fall, but their institution survived and hired new journalists. But it's not the same. I can't say it's the same Afghanistan. You know, the sense of fear is there. But in the same time, demonstration of bravery is also there. A lot has changed. But even if we get a much lesser number of genuine stories coming out of Afghanistan, it's better than nothing.
Nothing, or at least very little of value getting reported, isn't an exaggerated fear. Consider what journalists in Afghanistan are up against.
Hey! Calm down!
Media workers, along with activists and dissidents, are routinely targeted and jailed. The reporting restrictions ban anything that is, quote, contrary to Islam. Many female journalists are being kept off the air. And yet, the restrictions, while strict, are also vague. Nothing has been officially codified. The Taliban has issued no specific media law, so no one really knows what the rules are. In addition to all these issues is mass poverty. Food, medicine, and money are in dangerously short supply. And Afghan journalists attempting to report on this are contending with cold and starvation themselves. Life in exile is easier, safer, but those journalists are disconnected from the people and stories they care about, dealing with feelings ranging from relief to guilt.
I think if I had stayed in Kabul, I would have been just another person facing severe limitations and restrictions, and I would be numb, mentally and emotionally. Although it gives me some happiness to help my colleagues get out of the country and to be safe, I feel we are destroying everything we built in the past ourselves. Regaining the media's influence, training journalists, and bringing back all the experience that has been lost from Afghan media will take years.
The future of the media in Afghanistan will be unknown until there is an inclusive government. Until life for the people of Afghanistan is not livable, how can we talk about the future of the media? Many of my colleagues tried to stay to work and live in Afghanistan, but the situation was impossible and they had to leave. But not everyone can leave. And amongst those who have left, they were forced. They did not do it happily.
And finally, over the past 2 years, Mali, Guinea-Bissau, and Burkina Faso have all seen attempted military coups, some more successful than others. West Africa has been labeled the continent's coup belt because of a post-colonial history of political instability. But there is far more to the region than that. So we're leaving you with some recommendations, where to go online, outlets, and specialists serving up news on West Africa that runs deeper than juntas and regime changes. For English-speaking readers, there's West Africa Weekly, a Substack newsletter by journalist David Hundeyan. The Conversation Africa is an independent news platform led by academics and researchers. Their work also appears on associated sites in the UK, US, and France, among other countries. If your focus is on Francophone West Africa, we'd suggest Jeune Afrique and Article 19. On the podcast side, It's a Continent challenges some common misconceptions about Africa.
And welcome to It's a Continent, the podcast that decolonizes history one story at a time.
It provides historical context on various countries, including Nigeria, Ghana, and Burkina Faso. Finally, where to go on Twitter? We follow Ibrahim al-Bakri Nieh of the Center for Democracy and Development West Africa and Amaka Anku of the Eurasia Group. Ope Adetayo is a freelance journalism fellow at Africa Arguments, who is also worth tracking. We'll be keeping an eye out for West African media stories as well, and we'll see you next time here at The Listening Post.